Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
Welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network, where we supply honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest, the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And boy, I might get some naysayers today, although time will tell. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And as I said, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Now, listen closely to today's Twitter poll. Is Kate Brown's new vaccine mandate delay? Have you heard she's done that yet? Yeah, a lot of people are just getting the word. Kate Brown, who announced vaccine mandates starting back in the early part of August. And of course, when she started, it was for state employees. It didn't include the legislature. It didn't include the courts, but it included state employees. And then, just like Jay Inslee in Washington State, she began to say, we're going to pressure private employers, healthcare, everybody we can put the squeeze on. We're going to put the squeeze on them and tell them, take the jab or lose your job. October 18th is the deadline. Well, guess what? Something strange has happened. And this is where my personal belief is that Democrats should be careful what they wish for, especially Democrats in public office, because you might actually get what you're wishing for, and then having got it, you might actually regret it. If you said, I want the power to tell everybody in the state government workforce, I mean, we're talking about 50,000 people or so in round numbers, you must take the jab or you'll lose your job. And then when you find out, as the governor of a state, you might just lose tens of thousands of workers that you need to do their jobs. And you say, I can't have both. I can't have a vaccine mandate that gets rid of half the state workforce and then turn around and say, gee, I have no way to run the state because I just got rid of all my critical employees. And of course, this same kind of thing is going on in healthcare. And you've been hearing it about on this show because I've been getting emails and phone calls and all kinds of communications, everything. On Twitter, on Facebook, on Getter, on all these different places where professionals, doctors and nurses and people who work in healthcare have said, I've been told that I'm going to lose my job if I don't take the jab, but I'm not going to take the jab. Well, Jay Inslee, just Monday of this week, went hat in hand to the Biden administration and begged the federal government to give him 1,200 healthcare workers. And why is Biden? It would be a good mashup between the demented Delawarean and the climate expert from Washington State. Why is Jay Inslee begging for 1,200 healthcare workers? Because his policies have persuaded the hospitals to get rid of either hundreds or thousands of their employees, some of their most critical employees, and now they're in trouble. And it appears that Kate Brown is in trouble, too. And let me tell you what I suspect, and it's framed up in today's Twitter poll. Is Governor Kate Brown's new vaccine mandate delay saying, well, you're not going to get it by the 18th of October. How about we give you another 6 weeks? Is that a sign that Kate Brown shirt, we make that comparison because the Brown shirts were of the same kind of general demeanor as Kate Brown, is that a sign she's actually giving up on it? And I'm going to tell you why I believe that. I want you to ask yourself, but here's the way it's being reported, just so you get the mainstream media version of it. More than half of Oregon state employees now have an extra 6 weeks to get fully vaccinated against the COVID-19, with the deadline pushed back to November the 30th. The change affects about 24,000 state employees, represented by the Service Employees International Union, 503, out of about 42,000 state executive branch employees. And the reason I have to say executive branch is Kate Brown is happy to give orders to ordinary citizens, taxpayers, law-abiding citizens. She hasn't ordered the homeless to do this. She's not ordering the drug addicted to do this. She's not ordering the people in the courts to do it or the people who work for the legislature to do it. No, her orders are only for the serfs of her state because she is, after all, Queen Kate. It's unclear if the changes apply to the remaining 18,000 state employees covered by Governor Brown's vaccination mandate. But SEIU's success at pushing back Brown's initial October 18th deadline for full vaccination may bode well for other unions. My take on Kate's take another 6 weeks, let me tell you this. Somebody should put it to Kate. Do you really think this is about time that people who were told in state employment back in August, you have to get fully vaccinated by the 18th of October? Do you really think it was a matter that people said, well, I want to go take the vaccine, but heck, you know, a couple of months? I don't know if I can get it done in a couple of months. Everybody who's taken the vaccine understands this is not something that's terribly time consuming. But what Kate Brown is saying is, well, if I give you another 6 weeks to think about it, will you change your mind? This is not about time. This is about people saying, for whatever reason, religious reasons, practical reasons, scientific reasons that Kate Brown seems to have abandoned, philosophical reasons, for whatever reason, there are tens of thousands of people, both in the private sector and in government, who say, number one, I don't like being ordered around and told to do something. Number two, I especially don't like it when you order me to do something and then threaten to take me out of my job, to leave me without a paycheck, and to leave me, the threat is to leave me without credentials, to say to cops, to say to nurses, to say to doctors, why you won't be able to practice medicine in the state of Oregon. And it's no different in the state of Washington. People don't like being told what to do by so-called public servants like Kate Brown. You remember the relationship of government used to be the people consent to be governed. They choose the people who properly represent them, whether it's Washington, D.C., whether it's Boise, whether it's Olympia, or whether it's Salem. We choose to let you be the governing entity within a state. And we consent to be governed. And when the people who call themselves public servants, they get a big fat pension, they get a fat paycheck, when they turn around, especially those in elective office, and they say, now that you've given us this position and consented to be governed, we are going to tell you what to do. And if you don't do what we tell you to do, you're going to be without a job. You're going to be out of your profession. You may be forced to take your entire family and rip up your roots here in the Pacific Northwest and move outside the region, because you won't be able to work here anymore. And, you know, it's like the old threat in Hollywood. You'll never work in this town anymore. This is what Kate Brown tried. And it never apparently once occurred to Kate Brown shirt to say, maybe people aren't going to like this approach. So now what she's saying is, well, if you can't get vaccinated by October 18th, I'm pushing the deadline back to after Thanksgiving. And I have a feeling that between now and Thanksgiving, she's going to push it back again, because this is not a time issue. This is a people don't like being told what to do issue. And they especially don't like being told you must take the vaccine, but you can still catch COVID. You can still go to the hospital and die, like the 20% of the people who died in the state of Oregon in the month of August who had already been vaccinated and got the disease anyway. And despite all the promises of Dr. Fauci and Kate Brown and Jay Inslee, they had a tough go of it, and they died in the hospital. Yeah, that kind of situation. When you've got that kind of situation, a lot of people are going to say, I ain't doing it, Kate. I don't care if you give me 6 more months. I'm not going to do it. I suspect she's giving up. Coming up, well, we'll talk about the latest crazy plan to take care of the drug-addicted homeless.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Okay, I'd like to ask you the favor. Would you try to follow my logic on this one? Because I think there's logic in this, but yeah, I'm glad to take a naysayer call if somebody disagrees. It's one thing when homeless drug addicts spoil virtually every inch of public space in major Northwest cities like Portland, Seattle, Eugene, the Tri-Cities, Spokane. It's quite another thing when politicians decide to invite that kind of destruction. And I'll give you a case in point. In this case, it's in the Portland Metro. It's called the Expo Center. Now, if you've never been there, it's the product of decades of work and hundreds of millions of dollars of public investment. 1/3 of a million square feet. It was voted the number one mid-size convention and event center in America. So it's pretty nice. It brings in more than 100 events every single year. Usually they are multi-day events, which explains why you'd only have 100 events in a year. It brings in about $54 million in business every year. Well, now the rocket scientists at City Hall are proposing to build a homeless center and a tiny village and invite the same bums who have trashed the rest of the city, the same kind of bums that have trashed the rest of the Northwest, to set up camp at this gem. Now, what could possibly go wrong? Metro, the regional government, claims that even after the homeless camp is established, if it's established, Metro will keep on having expo shows. And that got me thinking this morning. I want you to imagine folks traveling to a city for a convention event of some kind. Maybe you're a vendor and you're selling things. Maybe you're just a customer, a citizen who wants to go to the gun show or the garden show or whatever it is that's being held at the expo. Driving past the literally thousands of yards of trash that are scattered all along on both sides of all major freeways, you almost can't avoid it. And the shanties that have been set up everywhere in violation of all the rules and laws and regulations that the rest of us have to abide. So you drive past all of that, and then you take the freeway exit from Interstate 5 right before the Interstate Bridge, and you exit at Delta Park, and you get the sight right in front of you of the massive, muddy tent city, believe me, I've seen it a dozen times in the last few months, before you drive on to the Expo Center parking lot, where you are greeted by more tents and more tiny homes and the derelicts who greet them as they enter the venue. And then you get out of your car and you lock it and you buy a ticket, if you're willing to still go in at that point, and you hope you come back to a car that has not been broken into. And then imagine what this is going to do. And every single time I hear cities say, and it doesn't matter which city it is, big cities tend to be worse at this. They'll tell you that every bridge has to be an architectural masterpiece. They'll tell you that every public space must be finished with the finest materials, that all the streetlights have to be of a certain design and a certain look, even if it costs a bundle of money to do it. And you know that Eugene and Salem, the Tri-Cities, Spokane, Seattle, they all do this. They all say, this is a public space. This should be something to be proud of. We're going to put down paver blocks. We're going to put down bricks. Yes, it costs a lot more money than asphalt or concrete, but hey, this has to look beautiful. Do you know what I've always mentally compared this to? I mean, imagine if Tina said to me, hey, let's put some brand new carpet in our living room. And I said, okay, we'll put brand new carpet in the living room. And then one day she comes home to find me with a big piece of equipment, maybe a dirt bike or a chainsaw, and I'm taking it apart right in the middle of the living room, right on top of the brand new carpet. Before she started hitting me in the head with parts of the machine I was working on, she'd probably say, we spent a lot of time and effort and money making this very, very nice, and you've now decided to destroy it? This is what your city government leaders have done. They've said spend tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on things like expo centers, convention centers, streetscapes in downtown areas. They've said, why, cost is no object. Spend as much as you want, and we're going to make it as beautiful as you possibly can. I mean, when the government is operating with somebody else's checkbook, they're willing to buy the best. And then allow, not just allow, but invite people to come in and trash it by turning into one more, you know, Wheelerville or one more Durkin Village in a place like Seattle or Portland. This is the insanity we're up against, that they will take things that you have paid for with your tax dollars, that you have paid for by going to events at these places, and they'll say, we're going to let a bunch of people who contribute nothing to the society, who use drugs, who steal, who act in an antisocial way, we're going to let them trash what you put all that money into. If somebody doesn't stand up and object to it, I will. Nicole Cup writes in on Facebook, Lars, I live in the Northwest, and during COVID, the city converted our sports arena into a shelter. Guess what now? A hockey team needs a place to play, and they have to uproot all those people and shuffle them somewhere else. Bad idea. She lives in Anchorage. And Ted Ricci writes in from Seattle. Seattle's going to host the 2023 MLB All-Star Game. The homeless and the street folks in that area of the stadium will not even be seen, as they will be conveniently moved. Wait for it. Now, I've made the comparison, I think. America is starting to behave like communist China. When you've got a big event, you go in and sweep out all those people. But you can't sweep them out just to satisfy the desires of people who actually live in your city. Oh, and then this from a big fan, Mark Christopher. He wrote to me with today's question of the day. about hunting. He said, Lars, we had a cougar just a couple of doors away last night at our house near Lake Limerick. Do many even hunt for the cats anymore since the issue of not being allowed to use bait or dogs or things like that? And I wrote back to him. I said, basically, both of the states, Oregon and Washington, have banned hunting with dogs to a large extent, unless, of course, the government is doing. Government hunters are allowed to use the dogs. Citizens are not, if that makes any sense to you. I said, a lot of us buy a cougar tag every year just in case we run into one. But no, there's almost no cougar hunting anymore, which means there are a lot more cougar and a lot more wolves and a lot more of all the apex predators out there, which means there are a lot fewer deer and elk and other game, which I think is exactly what the agenda is. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
I had somebody point out that apparently Ron Wyden is coming to the defense of the pornography industry. Yes, the senator who makes his home in New York City, he's actually been talking to people from the porn industry because they're concerned about changes to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Great job, Ron. Thank goodness you don't live out here. Today's best email, but you can always send more. This one comes from Kerry Wissman, brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Kerry writes in, Lars, I work for the Washington State Patrol. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the enduring problems of the Pacific Northwest, although there are problems like this in other parts of America, but one of the big problems for Oregon and Washington, a bit for Idaho, is the lack of what they call affordable housing. Now, that's a term invented by the government, and it is arguable to begin with. But government keeps promising, we will produce affordable housing. If you just give us enough billions of dollars, we will produce that. And they have shown themselves, at least based on the track record I've seen, to be absolutely incapable of doing the job, even when supplied with large quantities of money. And that's one of the stories in WWeek.com this week. That's Willamette Week. Aaron Mesh joins me now, the news editor for Willamette Week. Aaron, good to have you back. And tell me what this story concludes about the capabilities of government to come up with affordable housing.
Well, I mean, it's the conclusion that Nigel Jaquess has reached multiple times before, which is that this is no way to run a railroad, or in this case, to run an apartment complex. So we're looking at an incident here. This is a building called the Joyce Hotel. It was a flop house in downtown Portland on the West End. Then in 2016, the building owner realized that the neighborhood was getting fancier and said, well, what's the point of me having this extended stay hotel that attracts people in desperate straits? I think what I'll do is I'll sell the building and get it turned into something a little bit nicer. There was a great outcry. I don't know if you remember this, but in 2016, it was like the story of the month for a few months there. All the newspapers were writing about it, about what will happen to this building downtown. And then the city stepped in and the city said, okay, we will buy it and we will make it into permanent housing for the neediest people in the city, which is a very nice gesture. It sounds great. But fast forward 6 years later, and Nigel went to check how things were going. They're still at least 2 years away from opening that building up to anyone, and the price tag on it is extraordinary.
Yeah, Nigel's story, and Nigel is the Pulitzer Prize winner from Willamette Week. He points out that the whole project is $25.1 million, which is $400,000 a unit for a refurbished studio apartment, not brand new, which works out, and it's a number I like to use when I'm looking at housing, $1,198, just shy of $1,200 per square foot. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Nigel, $1,200 a square foot will buy you one of the fanciest condos in the Pearl District in the nicest parts of town, won't it?
It will. I think so. I don't often look at the square foot cost of the fanciest condos in the Pearl because they're not really in my price range.
No, they're not mine either.
Right? Like,
I think it's fun to look at the numbers.
Yeah, but it's sort of the point, right? Like, I'm not saying that to complain about our status. I'm saying that maybe the city shouldn't be spending that much money per unit. And it matters not because, like, the people who live there don't deserve it. That's not really the point. The point is you can't produce enough units to get those people off the streets. Like, the reason why it matters not to spend so much money per square foot on affordable housing is because you produce less units of it more slowly, and we continue to have this crisis, which is not only in Portland but across the West Coast,
yep,
of people who cannot afford someplace to live indoors. And, you know, we talk for ages, you and I, on this show about whether or not those people choose to live outside, whether or not those people have addictions. All of that is real, but the fundamental reality is that those people, many of them, would live inside if someone provided something quickly and at a low cost.
Yeah, and let me ask you about the cost. What does the city propose to rent these $400,000 studio apartments to people for anything near what it actually costs to do it?
No. I mean, I don't know the number, but it will be nothing. It'll be a pittance. This is what's known as subsidized housing. The whole point of this project is to essentially not charge anybody to live in it.
So it's not just subsidized, it's free. And as Tom Peterson, you say, free is a very good price. So what I don't understand about this is, Aaron, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and coming up with the same result or expecting a different result. There are so many people in the private sector who build housing for a living. And some of them, and we've featured them on this show, they've complained for years that they'll go out and build brand spanking new apartment units at a given price, and the city will say, we're going to build apartment units in the same neighborhood. And I think this is no different in Seattle. And the city's price comes in at 50 or 60% above what the private sector does. And then the next year they say, hey, let's do some more of that. If you already know what the result is going to be to a fair certainty, that they're going to produce something that's obscenely expensive. And I think $1,200 a square foot for a studio apartment is obscenely expensive. I mean, even if you take, let's see, what is the median cost of a house in Portland now? Is about $400,000. I think Seattle's about $650,000. I mean, do the math on that. If you're buying a $650,000 house in Seattle, let's say, and it's 2,000 square feet or 3,000 square feet, you're talking about a few hundred dollars a square foot. This is four or five times as expensive, and it's not that nice. Where the hell does the money go?
Well, I mean, I think the question that you're asking is, why do we keep doing this thing that seems to be a failure over and over? And I think there are a couple of answers. One of them is that I think that the city and the county and other government agencies get into a rut of thinking about things as if, like, the goodness of the intention is in fact the same thing as an excellent result. I also think there's a small pool of people that they tend to turn to over and over for this, and the people they turn to are not giving them the biggest bang for their buck.
No, they soak the city. And I'll tell you what, Aaron, I've had people complain. They say, Lars, all you do is complain about problems. And I say, well, identifying the problem is the first step. And they say, but you don't suggest solutions. I do. Sometimes perhaps I should be blunt about it. I've got a solution, Aaron. The West Coast is short of housing. California as a whole says it is short 500,000 housing units. Oregon is short, or Portland is short, you know, probably 50 or 60,000 housing units. Seattle, probably similar numbers. So here's my proposal. When somebody from the private sector says, I'm going to build houses or I'm going to build apartment units, the city immediately, city or county or both, come in and say, okay, you have to pay us $60,000 or $70,000 first. And you go, for what? And you go, for the paperwork. And honest to God, the starting cost to build a house or build an apartment unit are tens of thousands of dollars per unit. I have a great idea. Instead of giving $25 million to come up with 66 studio apartment buildings, why don't they say to the city and the county, listen, we're going to take a tiny fraction of that money, and we're going to say anybody who starts, who gets the permits and starts a project, let's say in the next 24 months, can have it with no system development charges, no permit fees, all the other government razzmatazz that adds $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a unit. All of that is going to be paid for out of this little fund. So instead of paying $400,000 a unit, you take $400,000 and put maybe $50,000 a unit into paying the city's ridiculous fees, and you get eight units for 400 grand instead of one unit for 400 grand. Do you think that has any chance of actually, and then let the private sector build it?
I couldn't agree more with the basic concept here, which is that you need to incentivize the private development of low-income housing. And the best way to do that, I think, is in fact to do two things, one of which you've suggested, one of which is to provide breaks from fees, which are one of the things, system development charges and other fees, which are one of the biggest impediments to building affordable units. So, or what they're called affordable units, although I tend to refer to them as low-income units or subsidized units, but who cares? The point is, you want to incentivize that by taking away some of the cost. The other thing you want to do that Nigel points out in this story is you want to be able to do something that they're doing a little bit of now but should do more, which is providing rent vouchers to people so that they can go ahead and live in existing units at a lower cost to them.
Not a bad idea. That's Aaron Mesh, the news editor. You can find the story at WWeek.com. It's written by our Pulitzer Prize-winning friend Nigel Jaques. Coming up, we've got your phone calls and emails on the Radio Northwest Network. It's a Wednesday, and it's the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, occasionally we have a little technical problems, and we did today. And I wanted to share an email with you, and I wanted you to hear exactly what this young lady had to say. Her name is Carrie Wissman, and she works for the Washington State Patrol. And then she gave a description of her job. It says CVE-02, which is Commercial Vehicle Enforcement Officer. And she works in Snohomish and Skagit County, has for 10 years. And she says, I absolutely love my job. I am not vaccinated, nor will I be getting vaccinated, but my employer, the Washington State Patrol, is forcing me to get it by October 18th to keep my job. After I submitted my religious exemption, I got a letter from HR stating it was approved because it's the law. The letter also stated that my job is not approved by Governor Inslee because I work with the public. And it goes on to say that unvaccinated people are a threat to the public, Carrie Wissman writes. I love how I was last year's hero and essential worker and this year's threat. I'm sending this email so I can get some help with legal advice and what to do and how I can get my name on any lawsuits regarding this order. Thank you very much for your time. Signed, Carrie Wissman. I wrote back to her and I told her the same thing I've been telling a lot of people, starting with go to firstliberty.org. And if you miss that, send me an email. I've been getting lots of them. We put it up everywhere because we want people to know. That's a nonprofit organization. I have no other financial ties to firstliberty.org. They're a great group. We have their lawyers on from time to time because for whatever reason in America, citizens need regular defense from their government on religious and First Amendment issues. So firstliberty.org, that's my first piece of advice. The second thing I'm wondering about, I began the hour by talking about Kate Brownshirt, the governor of Oregon, who it was a little over a month ago, announced that she was going to make everybody who worked for the state get the jab or lose their job. That was the threat. Get it by October 18th or you lose your job. Well, just today, the story, and I'll credit OregonLive.com has it, Governor Kate Brown has said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you another 6 weeks. And I think it's very clear that if somebody says, I'm not going to get the shot, that giving them another 6 weeks is not going to change their mind. I think what this is a couple of things, and I suspect that Jay Inslee may be in the same boat. He realizes, I hope both Kate Brown and Jay Inslee realize, they have created their own crisis. They are de-staffing hospitals. They are de-staffing doctor's offices and clinics. They are de-staffing state government. So Kate Brown has said, well, how about take another 6 weeks? Take till Thanksgiving and a few days past Thanksgiving. Get the shot by then. I think they're buying time for themselves because they realize that what they're about to do is cause the firing of either thousands or tens of thousands of state workers and hospital workers and the rest. And that this is going to create a problem. And when they say, oh, it's not us that did it, it's the crazy virus. And it's the unwillingness of people to get the shot, especially people who work in healthcare. Because you'd expect the people on the front lines, just like Carrie Wissman said, she was last year's hero. She was the essential worker. And now she's being told, no, you're a threat to the public, according to Jay Inslee. Again, I would suggest that a couple of things. And I think this is going to ramp up to something really, really bad. Because if Kate Brown and Jay Inslee, just like California, are going to say, we are going to force people to be fired, to give up their line of work, we're going to force them out of public employment, that those governors are not going to have a great explanation when the public starts saying, how come we don't have people to drive the ferries in the Puget Sound? Even WashDOT about a month ago was saying, we may lose a lot of our critical workers and lose them not by just losing them, but lose them because we told them you can't work here anymore. And are the bureaucrats going to have a good explanation for that? I don't think they're going to have it. So Kate Brown is trying to buy time. And if I've watched Kate Brown and Jay Inslee file their Tweedledee and Tweedledummer all day long and twice on Sunday. Every time one of them does something crazy or foolish, the other one usually follows suit. I'm going to predict that Jay Inslee is going to follow Kate Brown's lead and say, well, we're going to give you some more time to think about it. But I want you to think, and I'd be glad to take a naysayer call on this. If someone has said, I'm not going to take the shot, and you get the threat, or you're going to lose your job, I'm still not going to take the shot, fire me. A lot of nurses and doctors and hospital workers are in exactly that situation. If you say, well, maybe if I give them 6 more weeks to think about it, they'll do it anyway. They may get a few people to comply. I think this is buying time for the powers that be. What they're saying is, we're going to give you another 6 weeks till November 30th after Thanksgiving, and then they're going to quietly let that mandate just fade away, because both Kate and Jay are facing blowback from the public employee unions, who ordinarily support to the nth degree just about anything that the Democrats demand. Except this time, I think they took their demands too far. And Kate wants some more breathing room. Otherwise, she's going to be firing thousands and thousands of state employees, and she's not going to have an explanation for what happens when people walk into any state office and say, how come I can't get the state to act on this? And they say, because we don't have any employees, because we fired them all, because they refused to take the shot, and we realized that we were creating our own crisis. When you create your own crisis, it's not like the Rahm Emanuel adage about never let a good crisis go to waste. When you create a crisis big enough, the public is going to be incredibly unforgiving. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Your calls are welcome. Naysayers to the front of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and I'm always glad to have you with me. Even the naysayers, because actually naysayers get preferential treatment. If you dial into the show, 866-HEY-LARS, you'll join the best conversation in talk journalism. And if you're a naysayer because you disagree with my point of view, that's okay. We'll actually put you up front. I'd like you to consider today's Twitter poll. Is Governor Kate Brown's new vax mandate delay, a delay of 6 weeks, is it a sign she's actually giving up on it? And boy, is she going to be in a world of trouble. If you can imagine thousands of state workers who said, I hadn't planned to get the vaccine, but then they told me I was going to lose my job, I was going to be kicked out of the profession, I was going to be effectively unemployable in both Oregon and Washington because of this vax mandate for state workers, and now all of a sudden they're going to give it up? She needs to buy herself some time. So she's saying, take another 6 weeks. If you get it done by the end of November, then we're okay. I have a feeling this is going to be extended and extended. This is a ploy. I mean, the only metaphor I can come up with is if you have a son or daughter and you say, after high school, you have to either go to college or you got to go out and get a job and live on your own. And you set a deadline for your son or daughter. You say, by July 1, I need you to find a job and contribute to the household or you have to move out. And then you realize about June, you say, they're not going to make it. And you say, but I don't want to take the cost of kicking my son or daughter out of the house because they're not contributing. So I'll extend the deadline. Okay, September 1 then. And you keep pushing the deadline back. It's a Democrat sleazy way of simply giving up on the mandate altogether. Of course, if she does that, she's going to have all kinds of trouble because the unions are going to say, you forced some of our members to do something and now you've given it up altogether. She can't do that. She and Jay Inslee have both walked themselves into a corner. I predict that within a few days, maybe even today, who knows, Jay Inslee will do the same thing Kate Brown does. Any dumb thing Jay does, Kate usually does right after, and vice versa. So is Governor Kate Brown's new vax mandate delay a sign that she's simply giving it up? I would vote yes. And it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. One of the things I've endeavored to do over the years is try and feature some of the candidates for public office. We always invite the Democrats. We very rarely get a taker, but we're willing to have them on to make their pitch for, I don't know, high taxes, big regulations, whatever they want to try and sell. John Fosdick, he's a candidate running to replace Kate Brown's shirt as Oregon's governor. John, welcome to the program, and tell my audience, they're listening. I think most of them are voters. What would you do differently, and why should voters choose you to be the next governor of Oregon?
Well, I'd like to thank you for having me on your show. It's really awesome to be a part of something like this. I would have to say that the first thing I would like to do is to make sure that Oregon becomes a safer place and a safer home. I'd like to start by first bringing back the idea that we shouldn't be allowing certain things going on, such as the riots in Portland, the mask mandate, the forced vaccination, the way that our children are being treated in schools, the way that our police departments are being treated. There's a lot of issues going on in Oregon that really need to have a spotlight put on them. And I'm frankly tired of social media and those kinds of things, using things like the coronavirus and other such things to, you know, push people away from the real issues going on, trying to distract them with fear. And so if I became Oregon's governor, the first thing that I would do is I would start with a good audit of everything that's going on with the budget, what's going on with the different people in office, and I'd like to be able to bring a lot more transparency to the state.
What would you change? Or are you saying until you do the audit, you don't know what you'd change? I mean, would you have, for instance, we have one of the smallest state police forces in the West. We have a very small number there. That's under the control of the governor. Would you have a bigger state police department? You've already said you wouldn't. I take it you would not have a vaccine mandate or a mask mandate. Am I right about that, starting with?
Oh, that's 100% correct, sir. I personally refuse to wear a mask, and I personally refuse to get the vaccine because I honestly believe that the word vaccine doesn't actually apply to what the COVID, you know, quote-unquote vaccine is.
It's a symptom suppressor.
When it comes to police. Right. And when it comes to police departments, I'm a big fan. I grew up in Albany, Oregon, and I have some pretty personal love for the city of Albany and their police department and the way they handle things. So when I hear that, you know, there are people getting shot and murdered and such, it kind of confuses me because I never have seen any form of police department actually cause any form of brutality in my hometown. And so I'm a big supporter of local police and the state police. I think that the reason that they're there is to keep us safe, not to punish us and not to put us in jail, but to make sure that everybody is treated equally and following the law. So I definitely have no interest in defunding them.
John, what else would you change? Because that's you. I mean, if somebody says you got to make me governor instead of that person or instead of the other Democrats who are running, all of whom have been invited to be on this show, or any of the other Republicans, what would you change?
Well, I definitely would like to get rid of the red flag laws. I think that it really hurts our Second Amendment rights, and it makes it even harder for people to protect themselves and their personal property. I would like to look into the power grid. I would like to bring back the coal mines, because without an answer for our power problems, there's no reason that we should have turned it off. I would like to focus more heavily on bringing the timber industry back. I believe that is one of the ways that we can start to solve, you know, yearly fire problems. I'd like to really get a robust understanding of fixing the education system, getting all of this ridiculousness that Kate Brown has put into place, like the fact that our high schoolers are no longer really capable of going out into the world and being a part of society. I mean, what kind of higher education school like Harvard or Yale is going to take an Oregonian high school student seriously if they aren't even required to do reading, writing, and mathematics? I believe that Oregon should no longer be a sanctuary state, but instead I would like to turn Oregon into our first sanctuary state for veterans. I've been looking at the Oregon Constitution, and I noticed that inside of it we have a section called, I think it's Section 11F2, where it's about veteran bonuses, where we were giving World War II veterans pretty much, we were giving them a paycheck for either being a part of the service or being part of foreign wars. And I feel like the way that our country and our state treats veterans is deplorable. I was recently at one of the events across from the Capitol building on, I think it was September 5th, and there was a few hundred people there, but it wasn't as large as the one I went to on the 18th that was about the vaccine mandate. And so I'd like to give not only Oregonian veterans, but veterans all over the country a place where they can feel safe and secure and taken care of. I mean, I hear all the time.
Before I have to let you go, where can people find more about your campaign online?
Well, currently I've been pretty focused on Facebook. So just looking me up as John Fosdick. That's JohnFosdick.
On Facebook. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to the naysayer call and we'll talk about billionaires in space and you'll get my take. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. I'm always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And I'm always inclined to go to the naysayer first. So let's go to John, who's calling in as a naysayer. John, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
Lars, I'd like to see you use legal terminology when it comes to shut them down, Brown. What she is doing is coercion and extortion, and she's being a bully, just like the mafia did with people who had no contract with them. So I would like to see Shut 'Em Down Brown be arrested for coercion and extortion.
Well, okay. I could use fancy terminology. I'm not a fan of fancy terminology. In fact, it drives me crazy when bureaucrats and politicians use language that doesn't actually clearly communicate. I mean, you hear Democrats talk about revenue enhancement. What they mean is taxes, but they won't say taxes. But if they say revenue enhancement, then everybody can imagine that they're not talking about taxes. So if you want me to go more complicated language, I could do that. But simply calling it extortion, the problem is it doesn't leak. Number one, it doesn't meet the legal definition of extortion, because what Kate Brown is doing is under the color of law. Because as governor, she does have authority. I think she's exceeded her authority, but the courts have disagreed with me and agreed with Kate. So even if, though, we started calling it extortion and coercion and said why she's doing something illegal, number one, it doesn't meet the letter of the law. Number two, do you know who would have to bring charges against the governor? Criminal charges? What's that?
Yeah, her own people.
Her own people, just like the yeah. Biden DOJ is not going to bring. Well, the president can't be criminally charged till he leaves office. But even if he could, you're not going to see the Biden DOJ charge Joe Biden. And you're not going to see the Kate Brown's buddy, Ellen Rosenblum, bring criminal charges against the governor, no matter what kind of language we use.
I disagree with you about the extortion and coercion not being making a legal definition of what she's doing, because when you lose jobs because of her threats, that's exactly what happens when somebody goes and takes a torch to your business or something. It's the same thing that the mafia did.
It is generically the same thing, but it's under color of law. Does she have the legal authority? She would tell you yes. That's been tested. There are those of us who said no, she doesn't. And those cases went to court and we lost. So at that point, if a judge has said she has this authority and she says to state workers, you have to take the jab or lose your job, she appears to have the legal power to do that. And the challenge to it was already heard last year and it failed. So, John, do we gain anything by calling it that?
Maybe they're using the wrong legal approach. Maybe it should be under RICO.
Well, RICO, again, is racketeering in corrupt organizations. And I think generically she meets the dev. What's that?
And she's got one.
Well, except for this.
She won't listen to anybody.
John, I know, but just simply using different words to describe something, she's got a legal defense for what she's doing. She said, look, I've already been taken to court, and the courts have decided I have this authority. Now, I know that the unions are taking her to court. The Washington State Patrol officers are taking her to court, and we hope to get a decision from a court sometime soon, but it hasn't come yet. And until it does, I could use whatever language I wanted to describe it. It doesn't change her legal situation. So does it really? I mean, if I start calling it something else and say, why, she's engaged in robbery. Well, she's not under the law. So therefore, it doesn't do any good to change, you know, change the words you're using to describe it, does it?
On the vulgar side, I would say that we ought to be calling her what she is, and that's a bully.
Well, and actually, bully isn't too vulgar a term. I think she is bullying state workers. But, John, what I find amazing about this is you've probably heard the phrase, be careful what you wish for, you might just get it. Well, she wished for the authority to tell all state workers they have to take the jab or lose their job, and maybe even lose, not even be employable in both Oregon and Washington, because both states have said you have to take the jab or you can't work for the state. And this is why I think Jay Inslee is going to follow her lead fairly quickly. What I find disingenuous about it, John, and the reason I use that metaphor, you know, parents, there have been parents, I know people, friends of mine, who are told by their parents at 18 years of age, you move out of the house. Now, you may move out to go to college. You may move out because you got a job. But there is a deadline for you to move out of our house and live on your own, pay your own bills. And I don't think it's unfair for parents to do that. But what do we think of the parent who says to a child, when you get to 18 and you've graduated high school, when we get to, say, July 1 or September 1, you need to move out and be on your own. That is our expectation. I think there's nothing wrong with setting an expectation, but then you have to hold to it. If you say, we set an expectation, you'll be out of our house by the end of August, the year you graduate high school. And, you know, 4 or 5 years later, you run into your friends and they invite you to dinner and you show up at their house and here's Johnny or Susie still living at the house. And you say to them, what happened? And they say, oh, you know, we were coming up to the deadline and we realized our son or daughter was not going to go out on his own. So we extended it 6 months and then we extended it 9 months and then we've extended it 4 years. What does that tell you about the parents? It tells you that they really lied when they said there's a deadline. Now, I don't think Kate should have put the mandate in place to begin with, but she put it in place. She wished.
I think that we, the people, are sick of her mandates.
Well, I agree, but not sick enough to recall her. Two recalls were tried. Both of them failed. The second one failed closer to the first one. But there's no prospect for a third recall, not with a governor's election coming up right now. If you went to people and said, hey, give me a bunch of money so we can go out and run a recall against Kate Brown or Jay Inslee, Jay Inslee would be a better candidate because he just got reelected. But Kate Brown's going to be out of office. She's term limited out. Someone will replace her. God forbid it's Tina Kotek, the one who reneged on that agreement with the Republicans this week. And now the whole legislature is shut down, allegedly over COVID. Although if you ask me if I believe they've shut down the legislature over COVID, I think they shut it down because the Republicans called their bluff and said, we're not going to go along with this stuff. So in this case, I think what she's doing is trying to buy time. And what I would hope, John, and thank you for the call, by the way, what I would hope is that reporters from the TV stations, from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, the Oregonian, if they would press Kate Brown on this, when you've extended the deadline, what is the reason to extend the deadline? As I've said, I don't agree with the mandate, the no jab, no job mandate. But having said that, what would be the reason to give people another 6 weeks? Because if Kate Brown tries to run the argument, well, we're giving them another six weeks because they haven't had enough time to go get the shot. It doesn't take long to go get the shot. It doesn't take long to get the shot and then wait a few weeks and get the second shot if a second shot is required. What she's saying is, I hope people will change their minds. Well, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, I'll take a naysayer on that. If somebody says, well, there are people out there who, if you just gave them another 6 weeks, having said, I won't take the jab, I'll lose my job if I have to, but I'm not going to take it, that if you give them another 6 weeks to think about it, that they'll take it then. I don't think she will. And she's walked herself into a corner because now she faces the prospect that if she calls off the mandate altogether, you're going to have hundreds or thousands of workers who say, I took the jab because you threatened my job. And now you're telling me you're giving up on it because you can't get people to go along with your order. That's unacceptable. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Coming up in a moment, Well, with the cops we have left, because of the left's idiotic policies, are we ever going to get the cops back to full strength? We'll talk about it next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And all across America, you've seen big blue cities. By blue cities, I mean ones run by idiot Democrats who've said, oh, yeah, the mob in the streets is saying we've got to get rid of the cops. So we're going to, well, at least make a token effort. The token effort, of course, in New York City, I think, was a $1 billion cut to the cops. Other cities like Los Angeles, close to that. And smaller cities, tens of millions of dollars cut from the funding of local police departments. And then when we started piling up bodies in the streets and we saw more crime, more violence, more of all the bad things you have when there are no cops around, some of those cities have, well, they've said that they're going to change course. And they say, why, we're going to bring back some police to replace the police that we got rid of, which doesn't really make much sense. And there's another problem with that. When you go out to all those prospective police officers or officers working in another city or another state, and you say, we'd like you to come back. Could you come and work for our police department? And they say, well, we saw how you treated the officers you had before you got rid of them. We're not going to go to work for you. At least I think that's going to be the result. Lance LaRusso is an attorney. He's a former cop, and he's the author of the books When Cops Kill and Blue News, both of which benefit cop charities. Lance, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Are these cities likely to get their officers back?
No. Why would anyone do that? It's not a matter of, you know, what can I expect? This is not a matter of, hey, I forgot to invite you to my backyard barbecue. We skipped you on the invite list for my daughter's wedding. This is a matter of, we said we don't want you. We said that we have no faith in what you are doing. And from the officer's perspective, if I get involved in something that is a life-threatening situation, I will have zero support. So if they have found a new home that supports them, or worse, they have decided to leave law enforcement and take dozens, if not decades, of years of experience out of the mix from that city's law enforcement and public safety, why would they ever come back?
What are we likely to get in its place? And look, you're on the side of cops. I'm on the side of cops. I always tell people I always back the cops until and unless they break the law or break their own department's rules, which does happen from time to time. But what are we likely to get? Are we going to get good cops to replace them? If the new ones who come because of the paycheck or the pension or the benefits, or because they've always wanted to be a cop, but they don't have the same skills and talents of the officers that we lost, and they're willing to operate in a situation where they're told by some of the cities, don't enforce the law, don't arrest people, there won't be any consequences for lawless behavior, which is what a lot of police departments have effectively been told by their political masters.
So I think what you're going to have in the short term is you may have more people applying. You may have people saying, okay, well, I'll give them a shot. But you're probably not going to get back those people with the decades of experience who have walked away. And some of them have walked away completely from law enforcement. The bigger concern is a lot of them have walked away and told their families and friends and children, don't go into law enforcement. But my bigger concern is this is a crisis created by bad governing. And when crises are created by bad governing, the people that have the authority to change the rules often do so to protect themselves. And The real danger is in this effort to bring people back and refund police and revamp police departments, because the presence of law enforcement officers actually does deter crime. If they lower standards, we will be worse off than we are now.
Well, and that's the concern I've had about the military. I've never served in the military, but when the military said, oh, we want a more diverse workforce, and I've talked to generals and colonels, retired colonels, who've said there's only 27% of the population graduating from high school that's even physically capable or has the criminal record or drug record that would allow them to serve. I'm worried that departments are going to say, well, we have to be willing to take some people who are a little more sketchy than the folks we've been willing to take before, whether it's on the mental health exam, which most departments do, or the physical exam, or the knowledge exam. And like you said, when they lower the standards, bad things happen.
It's the criminal background checks, too. I know that over the past several years, probably about 10 or 12 years, we've seen concerns over the amount of recreational drug use that will pass as acceptable. And so far as people saying, well, you know, who cares if somebody smokes marijuana and they're a law enforcement officer? Well, it's illegal. Whether it's legal in your state, it is still a violation of federal law. So should an agency waive that requirement and bring that person on when that person has made a conscious decision, sometimes in numerous occasions, that they will violate the law because they've made a value judgment that it's not important? Those are not the people that we want serving as law enforcement officers.
Well, Lance, let me take it a little further, and you tell me if you're wrong, that you're the attorney and former cop. Even in the states where it's legal, it's generally not legal to do it in public, and that's what people get tagged for, and it's not legal to sell it to kids, and it's not legal to sell it without, you know, without having the state licenses and all that. So those laws still need to be enforced. If you have a police department that has a huge number of people who like to smoke dope recreationally, are they likely to want to enforce the law against something that they actually agree with, even though the law says this, you know, because the cop isn't going to bust into somebody's house to find somebody smoking a joint in a state where it's legal. But I know it's been problematic that they say you can't smoke it in public, just like in most states, you can't drink in public. Well, that gets violated all the time. And now you're saying we're going to have cops who say, well, I don't agree with the law anyway, so I'm just not going to enforce it, which they've actually seen DAs and city councils say. We don't agree with the law, therefore don't enforce it. And it becomes, you know, I guess it becomes up to the individual officer. Do I follow the same lead as the people I answer to who say if we don't like a law, we just don't enforce it?
Well, and I can tell you, despite all the jokes, lawyers do have a lot of rules they have to follow. And I'm just amazed by DAs who are elected and take an oath and then state there's an entire class of crimes that they will not enforce. You know, and when we look at the situation of officers, say, using marijuana, the danger is to the public. And I posed this to someone in Colorado a few years ago when they were talking about the legalization of marijuana. So this is several years ago. You know, the marijuana that certain, you know, popular politicians were not inhaling in the 60s actually is a much higher THC content now than it was then. The marijuana content, the THC content in the 60s was usually about 3 to 10%. Now we're seeing marijuana having THC content as high as 75 to 85%. So I said, are you comfortable with an officer getting off at 5 o'clock on Friday and smoking marijuana all weekend and then driving a car at 100 miles an hour on the interstate? And they said, of course not. I said, well, it's legal. So there are different thresholds. There are different standards that we hold people to when they're in law enforcement. If we start relaxing those standards, we're fraught with problems.
You know, my friend Ann Rule has pointed out to me over the years, Great Britain seems to be on top of this, that they say the higher potency THC pot that's being sold today, like you said, it's much higher than it was in the 70s, that it dramatically increases the likelihood of psychosis. And so it goes beyond just being driving the cop car while intoxicated. It may be that, you know, police departments spend a lot of time trying to make sure we don't have cops with the wrong, you know, psychological background. And then say, but you can smoke this drug that we know increases the likelihood of psychosis dramatically. I mean, it's hugely higher for people who are just smoking the average stuff. And if you're smoking the really strong stuff, the studies in Great Britain say, you know, the chance of psychosis is really high. And the last thing we need is people in a profession that involves life and death, split second decisions, not just intoxicated, but maybe even mentally impaired by what they're smoking, because one psychotic cop out of 1,000, that could be a real disaster. Lance LaRusso wrote When Cops Kill and Blue News. They both benefit cop charities. He's a former police officer and an attorney, and it's always great to have his insights on these kinds of issues. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. I'll get back to you and with your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. I'm always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You know, I saw a comment about the space ride that was taken by a billionaire. It was actually very notable because historically it was the first time that an entirely civilian crew of people had gone into space. I mean, there have been times before when we've sent civilians into space, but usually they're surrounded by professional astronauts. Well, the head of the United Nations ripped into Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson yesterday about this. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told other world leaders during his opening remarks at the UN General Assembly. This is the one where Joe Biden projected as much weakness as Joe Biden can possibly do in a speech at the same assembly, that the billionaires' race to space demonstrated massive gaps between the poor and the uber wealthy. This is from one of the reports on what Gutierrez had to say. He said that a malady of mistrust is spreading around the globe as everyday people see their rights curtailed and struggle to put food on the table. Well, most of them are seeing their rights curtailed not because of the private sector, but because of the government knuckleheads. And struggling to put food on the table? This world grows plenty of food for everyone. If you are short of food in this world, it is usually because, once again, a form of government, dictators though they may be, dictators decide you're not going to be able to eat. And frankly, in America, we've got an awful lot of people who could, stand to shed a few calories too. But what he said was, Gutierrez says parents see a future for their children that looks even bleaker than the struggles of today, while at the same time seeing billionaires joyriding to space while millions go hungry on Earth. I have heard this argument before. It is it's an argument that was made back during the time of the NASA space program. I think it cost us $40 billion to put a man on the moon. And people said, well, that's too much money. We're sending all that money into space. What they didn't realize, or I guess didn't think about, I was a space nerd, so I thought about it a lot, is that when you send men or women or dogs like Laika into space, that you're not sending the money up there. What goes up there is a few pounds of metal. And what you burn is a little bit of, in most cases, hydrogen and oxygen, and it turns back into water. The money stays on Earth. The science stays on Earth. The technology stays on Earth. And that seeing people go into space as a private enterprise, and the price is getting cheaper and cheaper. I don't think it'll ever get to my budget. I can't afford to take one of those space rides. I'd love to do it. But no, it's the province of billionaires right now. And so someday maybe it'll be millionaires. And then after that, maybe it'll get down to my tax bracket. I'd love to be able to do it. I couldn't imagine what it would be like to do that. But the good that comes out of it far outweighs the bad. And yet you've got people like Gutierrez bad-mouthing it, saying that somehow billionaires paying for a space ride and developing the kind of technology that nearly always has a benefit for those of us who stay on planet Earth is a bad thing. I just don't buy it. Let's go to some calls now. Let me go to first to naysayer Chief. Chief, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
Hey, Lars, I just want you to know I love your show, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you. There's usually a but at the end of that sentence.
No, just on this particular thing, I'm a hardworking man and a former veteran, and I've been smoking marijuana for 30 years, probably every single day, and I just always come across this argument from naysayers that the marijuana percentage is so much higher now than it was back in the 60s and 70s, which is absolutely true. My thing is people in the 60s and 70s smoked an ample amount of marijuana to get to the same point that people today will just take one or two hits to get to. I compare it very much to alcohol. Like when someone goes to get a drink, they can have three or four beers, and that probably heavily intoxicates them, or they can have one shot of Bacardi 151, and that does the same effect. I just don't think it's being construed properly that that people today are running out and taking multiple hits of this high THC. I myself used to smoke probably an eighth of marijuana, which is probably a lot back in my 20s. I'm 48 years old now, and at the end of any given day, I might take one hit or two hits of what is today 60% THC.
Okay, but can I throw something into the mix, Chief? Have you ever sat down with a friend and drank a bottle of wine?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Wouldn't hurt you at all, right?
Yes, sir.
In fact, if you drank, it's usually five glasses to a bottle. If you drank a whole bottle of wine by yourself, what would happen? You'd probably go to sleep or pass out or it depends on your tolerance. What if you drank a whole bottle the same size of Everclear?
Exactly. And that's exactly my point.
You might die. And all I'm suggesting is that, and again, I'll cite a good source. I mean, Ann Coulter's good on this because she's been on this issue for a long time. In the 1970s, the average level of THC in pot was less than 2%. Today, it's closer to 25%. And what they found is, I'll give you a couple of numbers that would tell you something. In the early 2000s, About 30,000 people were hospitalized because of psychosis for all kinds of reasons, right? By 2014, just a few years later, the number had gone to 90,000. That's emergency room visits for cannabis-induced psychosis. So it goes from 30,000 to 90,000 in a space of 8 years, 2006 to 2014. Is there a pattern there we ought to be concerned about?
Sure, sure. I just think that now with education and, of course, a little bit of self-control and moderation, I mean, when you purchase marijuana now from a dispensary, it tells you exactly how much is in there. So you're not going blind. You didn't just get it from some guy on the corner.
Do you think anybody ever pays it? Do you think the people who smoke pot pay attention to that?
I certainly do. There will always be people who are reckless and radical with their behavior patterns. But for most people that, you know, and I live in Eugene, a heavily pot smoking area, for the majority of people, you know, unless you're just some stoner sitting on the couch in your mom's basement and have no.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. I'm always glad to get your calls from around our Radio Northwest territory. That's 24 radio stations that serve Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And I'm always glad to get your calls. On Fridays, of course, we celebrate First Amendment Friday. That's a whole different thing. But today, even the naysayers go to the head of the line and always have on this program at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, I've been getting emails from people about a rather strange thing that they think is going on in the central part of Washington State. And I thought, well, when there are strange things going on, we want to call and find out what they are. What I've been hearing about, and the first time I got an email about this, I believe it was last weekend, when a young lady wrote to me and said, Lars, are you aware that they have set up a COVID isolation and quarantine camp in central Washington, and that they are staffing it with what they call a strike force? And what this young lady had done, and it was very smart of her, she attached to the email a job posting. And indeed, there is what is being called a isolation and quarantine facility. There's one in central Washington. There's apparently also one in Centralia as well. And people have been saying, what is this? Is Jay Inslee setting up quarantine camps in which to isolate and quarantine people in his state? Well, we can get the straight scoop from Sean Swope, who is a District 1 commissioner from Lewis County, Washington. Commissioner, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So is there a simple way to explain what this state-run quarantine and isolation facility is?
Exactly that, a quarantine facility that the state came in at the cover of darkness, put it in, and then notified the government, the county and the city that is what they have done. And then they proceeded to apologize that they didn't let us know to begin with. And there's no plan to remove it as well.
Well, who's going to end up in this facility, and are they ending up in there against their will, I guess, is the first question.
Well, no one from Lewis County can go to the quarantine facility, and from what we're gathering, no one that lives in the state of Washington can go into the facility. It's people that are from out of the country, possibly out of the state, who knows where they're coming from. They get put there off of cruise vessels, airplanes. They get shipped down from SeaTac or the port an hour and a half away to this small hotel right off of I-5.
Okay, so there's one in Centralia. There's one in central Washington. I think it's Ellensburg, but it might be a different town. But this is designed primarily for foreign nationals. Is it only foreign nationals, or could this also be people who are citizens of the United States, but people who, as you said, don't live in the state of Washington?
Yeah, we're not clear as to who is coming here. We just know that every once in a while we'll see a group of people that aren't necessarily quarantining because they're all hanging out outside in the hotel, you know, playing cards or doing whatever. There. And it's amazing because we asked for the contract and we had to fish around just to get it because they said that they would be leaving in December and the contract actually goes through April. And then the hotel owner is making $125,000 a month to have this facility there.
And how big is this? Hold on, Commissioner. $125,000 a month for how many rooms?
About 40.
So this is $3,000 a month? I guess that works out to about $100 a day if you're assuming that the thing is full all the time. So that's not even a terribly expensive hotel, is it?
Well, no, it's not an expensive hotel. I think average night probably costs between $60 and $90.
But the state has been willing to say, we did this under cover of darkness. We dropped it into your county. We don't want to tell you a lot about it, but you're expected to simply accommodate it. And you're told it's an isolation and quarantine facility, but people aren't actually quarantining at the facility?
Well, they would say that it's quarantining, but when you see them outside and they're all gathered around doing who knows what, you know they're not social distancing when we're told that we have to social distance. But the other piece of this is the state gets to do whatever they want, wherever they want, and they tell you how it's going to be, and you have to follow suit. But then the moment that you want to do something different, then that's wrong, and that's when Elle and I will come out, fine you, strip your business away, tell you that you can't go against the state because the state is the end all.
Now, how many of these things are there in the state of Washington?
I know that there's one here. I believe that there's one in Kent, and you mentioned one on the east side, which I have no idea about that.
And then this advertisement, and again, when I get links, I don't admire everything on the internet. I think the internet is full of junk, but it also has some good info. But these appear to be state job postings for what they call a strike force to work with.
Right.
What is that?
I mean, your imagination can only think of what it is. A strike force, someone that's going to come in and force you into quarantine is how I read it.
I mean, does that mean that, say, you fly in to SeaTac and you're a foreign national, you don't have a home in Washington State, as you said, it can't be people who live in Washington, and they're going to grab this person when they're identified as being COVID positive and say, we're taking you away an hour and a half to a facility somewhere, and you're going to stay there until what? Until you show clean on the test?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? You're going to fly into SeaTac. We're going to put you on a van or a bus, and we're going to ship you down an hour and a half away to an area that you don't know anything about, where there's very limited hospitals, there's limited stores, it's in the middle of nowhere, and you expect it to be okay.
Okay, one last question. I'm talking to Commissioner Sean Swope, who's District 1 Commissioner in Lewis County. Are these Afghans? Are they illegals? Do you know?
No, we have no idea who they are. We've asked several times for information, and all we can get at best is how many people are there currently.
And that's all they'll tell you. So how many people are at the Centralia facility right now? Do you know?
I don't know. I know a couple weeks ago there was probably over 20 people that were there.
And you don't have any idea who they are, where they're from, how they've been vetted, or why they're there? Because I would assume that there are people who come back from a trip and they fly back into SeaTac and they have homes in Washington State, but they have places to go to. And I assume that foreign travelers would have hotel reservations. I'm wondering if people are being taken there against their will. Commissioner, we're going to check back in with you, but thank you very much for the time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That is Commissioner Sean Swope from Lewis County. Quarantine facilities in the state of Washington. I wonder if there are any in the state of Oregon and how they're quarantining people in Kate Brownchurch territory. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I began the show today talking about Governor Kate Brownchurch's new vax mandate delay. And I think it's a sign that she's decided this was a bad idea from the start, which a lot of us also said. This is the mandate where Governor Kate Brown, under her so-called emergency authority, ordered that every single person working for state government had to take the vaccine or get fired. Now, then she had to amend it and say, except I'm not going to cover anybody who works at or for the legislature. I'm not going to cover anybody who works at or for the courts. Well, that's a big chunk of the state. But for the rest of the workers, 42,000 of them, she said, you have to get the vaccine, take the jab, or lose your job by the 18th of October. Well, today came the news that Governor Kate Brown said, hey, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you another 6 weeks to do it till the end of November. And I smell a rat here. And it's, you know, it's a Democrat. You know, you can't, but without those jokes, Governor Kate Brown has realized she's about to end up firing thousands and thousands of state workers. Now, there are a couple of problems with that for a Democrat like Kate Brown. Number one, the labor unions that represent those people are not going to take that kindly. And Kate Brown, even though she's not going to be governor after the governor's election next year because of term limits, she still has to contend with the unions. I think she plans a future in politics one way or the other. That's problem one. So she has to deal with the unions. Number two, if she fires enough people, and I think this same logic applies to Jay Inslee, she will incapacitate state government, as a lot of hospitals are now figuring out that they have told the doctors and nurses and other hospital staffers, yeah, have to take the job or lose your job, and they're running out of staff, and they're in trouble because of it. Except Kate Brown can then say, well, I'll give you another 6 weeks to think about it, as though time is the issue here. The issue isn't time. The issue is having a state government tell its employees, you must do this or we will not only fire you, but you will be unemployable anywhere else in the state. You'll be unemployable anywhere else in the state next door. So both Oregon and Washington employees are going to find that problem. So she's now trying to buy herself some time by saying, forget about October 18th. Let's make it November 30th. And I have a feeling that is going to get extended and extended because I think they realize, both Jay and Kate realize, that they have screwed up badly and they're now looking for an exit door and they can't exactly find one. Let's go to Kevin. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. So I'm an engineer on a tugboat and I got hurt a couple weeks ago. So they took me to Coulee Hospital to get my leg fixed.
Yeah.
Well, I had a clean COVID test that morning while I was getting the crew change, and then a positive in the hospital at Coos Bay, and they wouldn't let me leave, even though I had no symptoms and no apparent problems.
They wouldn't let you leave?
Yep, they said we had a quarantine there.
Why?
They said they couldn't risk us infecting anyone else. It took my company lawyer to get us out.
Well, I don't even know under what legal authority would they hold you in a hospital room. Did they tell you?
They put me in the ICU and they wouldn't let me sign to leave against medical advice for me. So I couldn't do it.
Hold on. Tell me what your injury was again. How badly hurt were you?
I broke my leg.
You broke your leg. Now, it was like a green stick fracture where it's poking out of your skin like in Deliverance, or just a broken leg like a broken leg?
Just a broken leg, and then my company said, we're not taking chances, we're taking you to the hospital.
Okay, and that's fair enough, but for a broken leg, they put you in the ICU?
Well, no, I got a positive COVID test.
Yep,
I got a clean one that morning because our company always tests us when we get to, before crew, when we leave the boat.
Yep.
And new crew comes on, they always test to be safe.
Okay, but which I guess is sensible, but Kevin, I'm not a doctor. You're not a doctor. If you're working on a tugboat, you're a skilled tradesman, but you're not a doctor. Do you think your condition merited going to the ICU?
No, I didn't. I thought I was going to get cast and be sent home because I had no symptoms. My blood oxygen was fine. I felt fine.
And yet they held you in the hospital. I don't know, Kevin, you're an example of something I was talking about the other day. I've got this spitball theory, and what it is this. If you want to hear it, the spitball theory goes this way, that you know, you have hospitals that get 80% of their revenue from elective surgeries, right? And all of a sudden, elective surgery gets shut down because of concern the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed, plus the hospitals are getting rid of a lot of their doctors and nurses with the vaccine mandate. So they say, or somebody with a spreadsheet says, hey, we just lost 80% of our revenue. It'd be like a tug company losing its biggest client for, you know, barges. And you say, where are we going to make up that money? And I spitballed this theory the other day saying, well, if all of a sudden they started putting a lot of people in the hospital for COVID, even though their condition did not really merit it, they still get to charge the government for that hospital stay. And so the hospital all of a sudden has money coming in again because they've created a new stream of revenue. And what I cited as evidence of this is that there was a study of the COVID admissions nationwide. And what they said was up to 50% of the people who were admitted to and put in hospital rooms or ICUs were either asymptomatic or had mild symptoms. Asymptomatic would be you. No symptoms, but you showed up positive on a test. If you fill hospital beds with that, it pays the same. You know, whether you're desperately ill or whether you really aren't, there's nothing wrong with you at all, like you described. This actually happened to you.
Yep. I was there for 2 days, and then I finally got out, and my wife came looking to come to Albany.
What? How did the lawyer finally get the hospital to let you go? Do you know?
I don't know. I got day two, nurse comes, okay, you're being released. Please sign here. After I called my boss the previous day and told him what was going on.
Now, Kevin, I'm guessing that you would ask the same questions I would. Why do I need to stay in the hospital if I have no symptoms? I'm feeling fine. You've already done my leg.
Yep. I've asked that multiple times, and they said, oh, because you're a contagion risk.
Well, but so is everybody else who has COVID. And if you had no symptoms, there are people out there right now who probably have COVID and don't know they have COVID because they're asymptomatic, just like you were. Aren't they all contagion risks as well?
That's what I thought. And we're filing a lawsuit against the hospital for this. We're working on it right now.
That's very strange. What was the reaction? I mean, when you told this to the company's lawyer, what did he say?
He said, what? He said, no, you should be free to go. He said, I'll be right there. And then they came down and they started making phone calls and doing their thing.
I mean, that is completely bizarre. But then again, hey, I never thought we'd have isolation and quarantine facilities in Washington State and strike forces, strike teams to go out and do whatever strike teams do in connection with an isolation and quarantine facility. Anything more you want to add to that? I mean, is there anything weirder than what you've told us already?
Nope, it was weirdest. It was the weirdest thing ever happened in my life.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, Kevin, thanks very much. And steer the boat straight. I appreciate this is what makes me think that somewhere out there, there's a hospital administrator who says, I've got to make sure my hospital has enough income coming in. We've lost all our elective surgery and much of our elective surgery. And now we got to figure out how to make that money. And if we take people who really don't need to be held, and I'll be glad to hear from a hospital administrator, if any of them want to talk about it, say, why would you put somebody who has a broken leg and a positive COVID test, why would you put that person in any hospital bed, let alone an ICU bed? Does that make sense to anyone? As always, naysayers are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm glad to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly, but I want to talk about another subject as well. Although all of these seem to roll together into one big, complicated, convoluted, and confusing mess, has the pandemic induced a move to online education, and has that made censorship better or worse in America's colleges? Nathan Harden joins me now, who's an education editor at RealClearPolitics.com. Nathan, it's good to have you back on the program. What's going on here that we go to a form of education that you would think would be even more, flexible for people, and then we find out that it makes censorship worse?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the program, Lars.
And, always.
This is the second year we've done the National College Free Speech Rankings, and this is a survey based on 37,000 students across the country who've given us their responses, telling us what the speech climate is like on their campus. This covers more than 150 colleges, so we're very excited to have such a large picture of what's going on across the country. And yes, okay, You're right that this year, 80% of students told us they're self-censoring at least some of the time. And that's up from what we found last year. So we're seeing that a move to the online education actually made a bad problem worse.
Well, and how much is it? Because I've noticed the other thing, Nathan, is that for whether it's connected to the pandemic and the actions of governments or not, there seems to be a lot more wokeism going on right now. So does some of that factor into it, that people are self-censoring because they're saying, oh my God, I've got this college telling me I got to use the right pronouns, I got to avoid trigger words, I'm going to get a complaint against me because I said the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person? Is that a piece of this as well as the online part of it?
It's part of it. You know, a lot of colleges have actually created these things called bias response teams.
Oh,
and
God.
They're asking students to actually report on their fellow classmates or their professors if they say something that might be offensive. So there's already that environment, almost an Orwellian type of environment at some of these schools. And then you add the online element, and people know in many cases these lectures, these online classroom sessions are being recorded. So there is the sense that, wow, if I slip up or say something that's offensive or interpreted as offensive, there's almost recorded evidence that could be used against me. And I think it's just added to that climate of fear that students were already feeling prior to the pandemic.
I mean, this means that young men and young women, and I guess I have to say young pronouns these days, but they are spending tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on an education, and they could put the whole thing at risk if they say the wrong thing, and everything they're doing is being recorded, which means that it's going to be examined under a microscope some other time?
That's right. And you know, one of the things you mentioned, cost, and this is very interesting finding in this year's rankings. We find that on average, if you look at the top 25 of our rankings, the vast majority of them are public institutions. These are not the elite private institutions that are doing better on free speech. And we found the exact opposite at the bottom of our ranking, where the vast majority of those were private institutions. So maybe you can save a little money, go to the local state, you might find a better speech climate there.
Can you figure out a reason, a causation as to why the public colleges would be, more tolerant than the private institutions would be more tolerant?
Well, you know, of course, we're talking about averages. So the actual the top ranked two schools in our survey this year were private institutions. So some of these private institutions are doing well, but I think you can look at some regional groupings, but you really need to go to the rankings yourself to find, your favorite school or the schools you're interested in and see how it's doing. And if you're a student, if you're a parent, if you're an alumnus, you know, this is some real information to figure out, you know, what's going on. We hope that people will use it that way. Just go to realclareeducation.com and search for your school.
I think a lot of these more
elite institutions, though, they may be a little more tapped into some of the political correctness, some of the language policing that we talked about.
Does this begin to sound like, I mean, I've read over the last couple of years, China has a social a program in which you basically either earn credits or demerits for behaving in a certain way, the way the government tells you to behave. Does this begin to sound like that?
Well, we're not that extreme yet, right? But I do think we're seeing more and more, not just in our colleges, right? This is a problem that's bigger. We all know this. People are losing jobs because of something they posted on Facebook. People are being ostracized by their friends or family. And unfortunately, this is happening on both sides of the political spectrum. We see more and more. But there's just there's an effect that social media in particular has in increasing political polarization. And we're seeing now a whole generation that's been raised on social media. Now they're in our classrooms.
I'm talking to Nathan Harden. He's the education editor for realclearpolitics.com, and you can read the whole story there. So what are the worst colleges and what are the best colleges? Can you give me the top and the bottom?
Yeah, our top five this year were Claremont McKenna College, the University of Chicago, which always does well in this survey, University of New Hampshire, Emory University down Atlanta, and actually Florida State for those Seminole fans out there. I grew up more of a Miami Hurricanes guy, South Florida, so I don't know how I feel about that. But, hey, they're doing well. down at the bottom, we have DePaul. I don't know what's going on at DePaul, but they have come at the worst spot in our rankings 2 years in a row on this, so they have a lot of work to do. Marquette, LSU, interestingly enough, Wake Forest and Boston College round out the bottom five. So it's a wide range of institutions there, but some pretty significant differences. You know, we asked students to tell us, you know, how comfortable they feel having difficult conversations on campus, or how open they were to hearing a controversial speaker be invited to their campus, and how much they felt the administration was supporting free speech. So all of these responses were something we translated into a numerical score, and each university was given their score, and that's how we figured out their rankings.
You know, a few times, Nathan, I've tried to get members of boards of trustees of universities come on, and because I figure if there's some kind of safeguard against a university going completely off the rails, I mean, you've got educators, you've got college administrators, you've got people who are professors, either tenured or not, they may all be trapped in the system. But in most places, both public and private institutions have a board of trustees or board of, chancellors. They have different names for them.
Right.
But they're usually made up of accomplished people from within the community who aren't having to pay attention to whether or not the professor likes what they write in a paper or not. They're people in the community who are being told, you help be the board of directors for this. Are any of them pushing back on this?
Well, I think what you're talking about is accountability, right? And
yeah,
really this rankings for the very first time gives us some accountability. We all know this problem of free speech on campus exists out there. We hear about anecdotal stories in the news, but never before have we really been able to put a specific score on a campus by campus basis. And so now I think, you know, if you want to talk about alumni, you want to talk about boards of trustees, senior college administrators who may want to, hey, how can we improve things on our campus next year? Now there's a set of tools that can provide that accountability both for students and parents and also for those who are in charge of running these institutions. That's something to be really excited about.
I would think so, too, because, Nathan, look, I went to school for a time. I didn't finish, but I went to college for a time, and I always thought college campuses were supposed to be full of diversity of thought. And these days, it sounds like you've got to comply or you're out. Nathan Hardin is the education editor at RealClearPolitics.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll today is Governor Kate Brown's new vax mandate delay, a sign she's giving it up. Now, I've had a lot of emails from people saying, I can't find that story anywhere. Well, I'll give full credit. OregonLive.com says that more than half of Oregon state employees now have an extra 6 weeks to get fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The deadline originally set by the late Kate Brown, now that's Governor Brown's shirt, has now been pushed back from October 18th to November 30th. And I've suggested to you a 6 week delay. I don't think that's real. This is not about time. If you say to people, you will get the vaccine or you will get fired, and people say, I'm not going to do it, and they put Kate Brown and Jay Inslee by extension, although Jay has not done the extra 6 weeks, although I could imagine him doing it the next day or so. Kate Brown says, no, now you've got an extra 6 weeks, as though six more weeks to think about it. If you've already taken the position, I'm not going to get the vaccine. If you have to fire me, you're going to fire me. An awful lot of those people in state employment have emailed me and said, what should I do about this? Go to firstliberty.org. They have a toolkit for applying for a religious exemption. And then what we've seen both state government and private institutions like hospitals do is say to those people, we'll grant your religious exemption. You're getting the exemption. However, you will not be scheduled for any work and you will not be getting a paycheck. They are constructively firing people, something that I'm not a lawyer, but it doesn't sound legal to me, because the law requires that your employer take account of a number of things. One of them is a religious exemption. One of them is physical disability. If you show up at work and say, boss, I'm in a wheelchair for the next 6 weeks, or I'm in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, your boss can't say, I'm going to fire you. I don't want somebody in a wheelchair. They have to make reasonable accommodations. And if an employer were to say to a disabled person, here's your reasonable accommodation, we're not going to schedule you for any work and we're not going to send you a paycheck, you can't do that. Now, I think the states are applying the same logic to this that Joe Biden has lately. Oh, it's not legal for me to do this? Well, I'll do it until I get called on it. It's something that 16-year-old boys sometimes do in driving automobiles, as I've compared before, that you say, well, it's legal until somebody catches me. Well, guess what? It seems as though Kate Brown has been caught. And Oregon Live has the story that Kate Brown is now saying, well, I'll give you another 6 weeks to think about it. I would just ask you, if you have a friend or a family member who's already said, I'm not getting the jab, I don't care what they do to me, if I have to go find another job, I'm not going to be happy about it, but I'm not getting the jab. If you're then told by your boss, well, can you take another 6 weeks to think about it? Maybe you'll change your mind. How many of those people are going to change their minds? I don't think it's going to be many at all. Let's go to Brady in Everett, who's listening on KVI out of Seattle and on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Brady, what's on your mind today?
Well, Lars, I'm listening on my phone, but hey, I like to refer to the Oregon governor as the Sorostitute Kate Brown.
Yep, that's accurate.
But hey, I wanted to make a point. You know, 6 weeks also gives people time to find another job, right? But
I guess
this.
With this exception, Brady, if you're a doctor or nurse, and you've been told every healthcare institution is under the same ridiculous rules from Kate and Jay, and they're all going to demand, you know, jab or no job, then where are you going to find a job? Somewhere outside the Pacific Northwest?
Right, exactly. I mean, think about what this is doing to our healthcare system when all these people are just going to refuse. I mean, it's going to turn our healthcare system into typical socialist, you know, third world type healthcare system, which is
the proof of what you're saying is that just Monday, it was either Monday or Tuesday, Jay Inslee, governor of Washington, went to the Biden administration hat in hand and said, I need 1,200 healthcare workers. I don't know where the Biden administration is supposed to go down to Walmart and buy 1,200 healthcare workers. I mean, where do you go fill an order like that? But even if they could do it, wouldn't the logical question to a governor be, well, how'd you lose 1,200 healthcare workers? Oh, I got them fired. I put down a rule that they couldn't comply with, and so I've got to replace them. I mean, that's stunning.
Right, exactly. Hey, the reason I called, I wanted to make a point about ivermectin.
Okay.
The media is pushing this narrative that it's for horses, right? No. When I was a kid, I trained horses and took care of horses, and we would worm horses, and it says right on the bottle, don't take so much per body weight, right?
Right.
We did it. It didn't make us sick, and it made the horses really healthy. We do it all the time. But regardless, you can get a prescription, right, from a doctor. And if doctors push back on people, what they need to do, go and to a simple search, Google or DuckDuckGo, and type in NIH Table 2E, and that will pull up the list of approved or under review treatments for COVID. The number two medicine on there is ivermectin.
Yep. And by the way, Brady, to back up your point about it being for horses, yes, it's also used for horses. But Merck, that came up with it, they got a Nobel Prize in medicine for doing this, because their primary use for it a long time ago was to tell people in third world countries who drink crappy water end up getting parasites, just like, you know, your horses would get parasites because they probably drink out of streams and stuff. Merck came up with that drug to cure river blindness and get rid of the parasites that were damaging a lot of human beings. This stuff has been used, I suspect, on a lot more human beings than it's been used on horses, but you're absolutely right. Thanks for the call. It's the Radio Northwest Network.